So tonight I want to talk about the Vatupama Sutta. It's called Simile of the Cloth. This is from the Majjhima Nikaya, number 7. This is the number one really famous sutta, and number two, it's part of a sort of a certain style of sutta, a sort of class of suttas, where the Buddha explains the progression that people go through. From starting the practice to enlightenment and the process they go through. And every one of these I've found are different in some way. They have different emphases and different things. And this one starts with this wonderful sutta. And I will read this. This is verse number 2 of the sutta. Bhikkhu, suppose a cloth defiled and stained, and a dyer did in some dye or other, whether blue, yellow, or red, or carmine. It would look poorly dyed and impure in color. Why is that? Because of the impurity of the cloth. So too, when the mind is defiled, an unhappy destination may be expected. Bhikkhu, suppose a cloth were pure and bright, and a dyer dipped it in some dye or other. Whether blue or yellow, red or carmine, it would look well dyed and pure in color. Why is that? Because of the purity of the cloth. So too, when the mind is undefiled, a happy destination may be expected. So here he's talking about where we have to begin with this practice, and this is something that he comes back to over and over and over again. In fact, In the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha's instructions on mindfulness, the very first thing he says is, this is the direct path for the purification of beings. And be careful with the word purification, because one thing is sometimes we sort of react with like, ooh, it's like it's a little too sort of esoteric or too sort of something. Anyhow, it sort of bothers people, the word purification. And basically, how to avoid that is we have to be careful to not get caught up in A, that sort of feeling, but B, that idea that somehow, well, I'm not pure enough, so how can I possibly do this? This is the path. It says this is the direct path for the purification. In other words, this is a process. It's a long process. He's using this image of dyeing a cloth because what he's saying is, well, first of all, before you start getting dyed, you have to make sure you have to do some work on the purification, on this very simple world of living in the world correctly. And then the dye will work better. Otherwise, it's like you're dyeing a dirty cloth, right? This is an image that the Buddha, the kind of thing the Buddha uses all the time, where this is an image that everybody would understand, because if you wanted to have colored cloth back in those days in the agrarian world they all lived in this village society, you dyed your own cloth. That's how it was, unless you were really rich, I suppose. But like the vast majority of people, they would know about how to dye a cloth because that's something they did. So it's like he's using this image, they would understand it. You take a cloth that's all dirty and you put it in dye, well, of course, that's not going to look very good. So this is like an image that everybody would get right away, more so than in our culture these days. How many people dye their own cloths these days? I mean, back in my hippie days, I may have done some tie dyeing of t-shirts and stuff, but beyond that, I have never messed with dyeing at all. Anyhow, that's the idea here, is that have to go through this process, and the beginning of the process is this process of purifying, of making our life more wholesome. But it is a process. It's step by step. It isn't like I have to be perfectly pure before anything else is going to work. It's like as long as I'm working towards that, that's what's important. But to make sure, the Buddha then does this This makes this wonderful. What bhikkhus are the imperfections that defile the mind? And then he gives this very sort of complete list. Being the Buddha, he wants to make sure we understand. Covetousness and unrighteous greed is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Ill will, anger, resentment, contempt, insolence, envy, avarice, deceit, fraud, obstinacy, rivalry, conceit, arrogance, vanity, negligence is an imperfection that defiles the mind. So this is like, this is classic Buddhist teaching. Let's make a very complete link. These, remember that all these things, these are things that we have to work on, that we, you know. And then he says, knowing that covetousness and unrighteous greed is an imperfection that defiles the mind, a bhikkhu abandons it. Knowing that ill will, etc., and he goes through the whole list again, is an imperfection that defiles the mind, a bhikkhu abandons it. And so this is important, and it's we have to see, first of all, we have to understand, and somehow, and I think this is really true, I think we all know, we all understand at some level, this really isn't a very good thing to do. And then we make some elaborate excuse to do it anyway, right? Like, because it'll make people happier. Who knows? Oh, I'll only do it this one time. Yep. Only this one time. Whatever. We're very skilled at making excuses. It's called being a human being. And the other thing is that we start to see these things arise in our practice. Like we start to remember things. We start to see ourselves craving. We start to see ourselves doing all these things, or having done all these things, or wanting to do all these things. As we practice and our mind gets stiller and clearer, it's like, oh yeah, that's there too. We somehow think that meditation is all, I'm just going to be there and be pure and calm and still. What actually happens in this practice, of course, as I'm sure you've all noticed, is all this stuff's up that we didn't want to think about, or that I don't remember about that, or I don't want to think about that tendency. And we don't want to see our darks. And this practice brings up our dark side over and over again for us to look at and go, see, here's another way, if you're not careful, where impurity will arise. And this is something you have to work on. And I also like the word that he uses. He says, this is when we see that this is true, then we have to abandon it. And I actually looked up, I like the word abandon. And I said, here's the dictionary definition, right? To leave completely and finally, forsake, utterly, desert, or to give up, discontinue, and withdraw from. So it's not like, well, give it up a little bit. It's like this, what we have to do is we have to actually not go there anymore. And this is the hard part of the practice, because there's our culture and our life tends towards that direction, because that's what our culture encourages us to do often. And so it's like we're going against the common flow of life. We're going against how people normally act often by consciously deciding to abandon the impurities. It's difficult just because we like doing some of this stuff, number one, but also it's because, well, everybody else around us is sort of like this, and they're saying, well, what's wrong? How come you're trying to not do this? I mean, why would you bother? We get that sort of reaction from people. But it's like the beauty of this practice at the same time is mindfulness is what lets us see these things. Mindfulness is what brings clarity and go, oh, yeah, I see where this goes. I know where this goes. I've been down this road before lots of times, and I always know where I end up in some unhappy suffering destination, guaranteed. I know what's going to happen. So that's the power of mindfulness. And so what we're really talking about is having right understanding. This is, in some senses, a definition of right understanding, seeing that these things lead to, what's the exact words here? I like them. They defile the mind. Yeah. They defile the mind. And I don't want to have a defiled mind. I want to have a clear mind. And that's the dot. And when we talk about what the practice is about, it's about having a clear mind as opposed to one that's defiled. Because these things just stir us up and we get lost in all those stories about them and blah, 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 blah. And so basically what the Buddha is talking about here is at the beginning, we have to develop right understanding and right intention. Right understanding, these are defilements, these are impurities. Right intention, I'm going to do something about this. I'm going to see if I can shift away from this way of acting and being and thinking and speaking, and instead shift towards the wholesome, the positive. This is where the practice always has to begin. But then the Buddha goes on. So it says, Winnicke has known that covetousness and unrighteous greed is an affection that defiles the mind and has abandoned it. When the bhikkhu has known ill will, and once again, he goes through the whole list just to make sure, he acquires unwavering confidence in the Buddha. Thus, the Blessed One is accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime knower of the world, incomparable leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, enlightened and blessed. He acquires unwavering confidence in the Dhamma. Thus, the Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One, visible here and now, immediately effective, inviting inspection, onward leading, to be experienced by the wise for themselves. He acquires unwavering confidence in the Sangha. Thus, the Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples practicing the good way, practicing the straight way, practicing the true way, practicing the proper way, that is worthy, that makes them worthy of gifts, of hospitality, of offerings. And then they live in this unsurpassed field of merit for the world. Oh, isn't this interesting? What he's talking about here is taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. Oh, so he's saying once we go off on this road of purity, of moving towards purity, of trying to practice purity, I suppose we should say, then the next thing we have to do is take refuge. This is why at the beginning of every time I practice, I chant the refuges to remind myself of this, and hopefully remind you as well. Part of what I'm trying to do. But to be honest with you, definitely to remind myself, this is taking refuge is essential in this practice of where everything has to begin. Once we've got past that place of figuring out, oh yeah, this is what I got to do, then I have to understand I can't do this on my own. I need to take refuge. And we take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. But what does that mean? what does it mean to take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha? And I want to talk about this a fair amount because it's really important that we understand this, because this is the foundation. This is the foundation of the whole. Once we've decided to get our life together, then take refuge is the next big step we have to do. So If we were culturally Buddhist, in other words, we were born in a country where everyone is Buddhist, or someplace we born older into a Buddhist family, because that's certainly going on all the time now. Then, so if we grew up Buddhist, we might have an actual feeling of this person, the Buddha who lived 2,500 years ago. But for most of us, that's probably not true. Like, because we came to Buddhism later in life, we didn't grow up Buddhist. We don't have that cultural sense of it. And so we don't have sort of deep personal culture link that people who grew up in these cultures have. So instead, taking refuge in the Buddha for me means taking refuge in the idea of the Buddha. You know, this person who reached enlightenment through his own efforts and then went on to teach what he had learned. So he's sort of an example of what's possible for all of us. Or we mean what he called our Buddha nature. You know, this the fact that not only did he do this, so not only is he an example, he said very clearly many, many times that we all have Buddha nature, that we all have bodhicitta, that we all have this capability to move towards enlightenment, to lead this life. It's like that's inherent in being a human. So I actually want to read some more. This is from another sutta, and this is sutta where the Buddha is describing what happened right around when he became, just before he became enlightened, and then what happened after he became enlightened. But I think it's kind of useful because it kind of helps you understand what I'm saying here. So this is 26 from the Majjhima Nikaya for those of you who like to follow along. I consider thus. So this is, he's just become enlightened, and now he's going, now what the heck do I do now? I considered this Dhamma that I've attained is profound, hard to see and hard to stand, peaceful and sublime, unattainable by mere reasoning, subtle, to be experienced by the wise. But this generation delights in attachment, takes delight in attachment, rejoices in attachment. This is 2,500 years ago he's describing today's generation. It is hard for such a generation to see this truth, namely specific conditionality and its origination. It is hard to see this truth, namely the stilling of all passions, the relinquishing of all acquisitions, the destruction of craving, passion, cessation, nibbana. If I were to teach the Dhamma, others would not understand me, and that would be wearying and troublesome for me. So he's going, God, no, people aren't going to understand it. It'd be a real drag to try and teach this stuff to people. Luckily, then, this is the nurse. Then, bhikkhus, the Brahma Shamapati, so this is a being from one of the celestial realms, knew with his mind the thought in my mind, and he considered, the world will be lost, the world will perish. Since the mind of the Tathagata, accomplished and fully enlightened, inclines to inaction rather than to teach the Dhamma. Then, just as quickly as a strong man might extend his flexed arm or flex his extended arm, the Brahma Shamapati vanished in the Brahma world and appeared before me. He arranged his upper robe on one shoulder and, extending his hands in reverential salutation towards me, said, "Venerable sir, let the Blessed One teach the Dhamma. Let the Sublime One teach the Dhamma. They are beings with little dust in their eyes." Phrase. There are beings with little dust in their eyes who are wasting through not hearing the Dhamma. There will be those who will understand the Dhamma. The Brahma Samapati spoke thus. So this celestial being basically said, no. Don't go towards inaction. Do something. Go teach the Dhamma. And so then the Buddha says, then I listened to the Brahma's pleadings, And out of compassion for beings, I surveyed the world with the eye of a Buddha. Surveying the world with the eye of the Buddha, I saw beings with little dust in their eyes, and with much dust in their eyes, and with keen faculties and dull faculties, with good qualities and bad qualities. And I'm deciding I'm going to go teach. And this is what he came to, because he was encouraged to do so, essentially. So one part of him was drawn simply to, oh, this is great. I'm enlightened, and just, it's wonderful. He says, he would say, I'm the one who no longer suffers. But another part of him, whether you believe in the Brahma Samapatti actually coming, or some experience of that nature occurred, doesn't make any difference. He saw that he had a duty. He had a duty to go out there and teach. He saw that everyone had Buddha nature, and that this was possible for everyone. So, in a sense, taking refuge in the Buddha means we're taking refuge in this possibility, that some of the dust can be washed from our eyes through the practice, through the Buddha's teachings. I love that image, because it's like, oh, if you have dust in your eyes, you can't see clearly. And what often this practice, one way this practice is described is like as a way to see clearly. We have to get the dust out of our eyes so we can see clearly. And some of us maybe have mud instead of dust, but it's like we're all working at it as best we can, right? And some days I probably have mud, and some days I have dust, for that matter. We can't understand what this means on a sort of a rational level. We can only feel somehow that it seems right. Yet this makes sense to me at some level other than figuring things out level. It just feels right. And certainly that's true for me anyway. But so taking refuge in the Buddha is essentially an act of faith. We have faith that the Buddha existed, and that he actually said what he said, and that we all have this possibility. We're all inherently Buddhas in the waiting. This is an act of faith, because I can't know that in the purely rational sense. I can only sense that, feel that. Then there's the second one, we've taken refuge in the Dhamma. And the Dhamma basically means the teachings of the Buddha. The record that has come down through the ages from his 40 years of teaching that came after his enlightenment. The Dhamma is like this incredibly detailed map that lays out, oh, here's how you can do it. And the beauty of a map, of course, is there's lots of different routes. I want to get from here to there, wherever there is, right? But I can go on this road. I can, maybe I can hop on the expressway. Maybe I can take this back country road. Maybe I'll sort of wander through some villages for a while, whatever. So there's lots of different ways. And in the 40 years of teaching, he spoke in very distinctly different ways about different ways of doing it. Always with the base of the Four Noble Truths, at the base of everything. But pointed in different directions depending on people's tonalities and predilections and that sort of thing. So, but how do we take refuge? What does it mean to take refuge in the Dhamma? It means we have to choose to actually study it. We actually look at it and go, oh, yeah. So this is where study comes into the practice, I think. And it's like, and study, I'm using study in the broad sense of the word. I mean, study could mean, coming to a Dhamma talk about a sutta. So in other words, you're all studying right now. It could be actually, reading the sutta, or it could be reading commentaries on the sutta, or it could be reading books by teachers who refer to the sutta frequently, but it's like we have to sort of put energy into this. We have to put effort into it. So as we're taking refuge in the Dhamma, it's like, oh, isn't the Dhamma great? No, it's like, isn't the Dhamma great? And I'm going to do what I can to understand it, study it, absorb it. And so this implies that we actually have the, you know, it's an act of effort. To take refuge in the Dhamma implies effort. It's an act of effort and energy that we're forming the intention to do. There's right intention arising again. Then there's taking refuge in the Sangha. Well, what does that mean? Well, there are two classical meanings to this. Traditionally, the Sangha means all those over the last 2,600 years since the Buddha first became enlightened, who have become enlightened themselves following the Buddha's teachings. You know, in the sutta, there are, you know, dozens, hundreds of people who, you know, have some meeting with the Buddha and some discussion and some teaching, and later on they become enlightened. It's like it's a pattern you see over and over again in the suttas. And this is like right at the very beginning. It's like this, those countless others who have followed the Buddha's teachings over the last 2,600 years and have become enlightened. And I want to read, this is that same sutta I was talking about earlier, where the Buddha's talking about his early life. Well, after he decided, okay, now I'm going to teach. I can't just go sit in the forest for the rest of my life. I have to, you know, do something in the world. I have to teach the Dhamma. He first thought, who am I going to go teach? And his first thought was, there were two teachers he had very early on in his practice time after he ran away from home. And he thought, oh, I should go hang out with them because they had very little dust in their eyes. And then he, through his sort of psychic powers, he realized that both those teachers were famous teachers of concentration techniques in day, had both passed away. So it's too late. I can't talk to them this time around. And then he remembered these five guys he used to hang out with in the forest. You know, and they were practicing this particularly austere form of practice where basically the idea was, well, we can see that suffering's a problem, so we better do whatever we can to really understand suffering. And the best way to do that is to make ourselves suffer as much as we possibly can. Starve ourselves, live out in the forest, have no house, no clothes. I mean, just like it was very austere practice that he did for a long time. And then one day he woke up and said, no, this isn't working either. And went on to the next phase of his life, where he actually ended up sitting under the Bodhi tree and becoming enlightened. But he said, no, those five guys, they were pretty, they didn't have much dust in their eyes. And he knew where they would be because it was a certain season where they'd gather together in this place, and he was going to go and be with them there. So he actually goes to be with them there. When he first shows up, like he had basically, you know, broken with them. He said, you know, I'm sorry, this isn't working for me. I'm going to go. And, you know, he actually accepted a bowl of rice porridge from a woman, which is even more shocking. And, you know, it was like, you know, totally against everything these guys believed in. And they were like, oh, that backslider, Gautama. Yes. So here he comes, he's walking towards them, and they're sort of like yelling, catcall, you know, that backslider Gautama, look how fat his cheeks look, sort of stuff, you know. But once he got closer, they realized he was like, there's something really different about this guy now. What? And they basically asked him, what happened? And he said, I'm the one who no longer suffers. Which for them was a declaration of, oh, this guy's enlightened. And they said, oh, so, okay, please, they tuned into this quite a way, and then please teach us. And here's a description of what happened. Then the bhikkhus of the group five, thus taught and instructed by me, being themselves subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, seeking the unborn supreme security from bondage, nibbana, attain the unborn supreme security from bondage. Being themselves subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, having understood the danger in what is subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, seeking the unaging, etc., etc., the knowledge and vision arose in them, and they became enlightened. So the very first time he taught. So they were the first members of the Sangha. And then all through the next 40 years of his life of teaching, there's countless people just at the time. And then ever since then, his disciples have taught and other people, you know, it's been going on and on for 2,500 years. So that, and why this feels important to me, why I have so much time talking about it, is it's like, oh, this actually works. And that wasn't just the Buddha. It wasn't just this one person. It's like, he said there's others who can do this, and sure enough, that's happened and goes on happening to this day. People are becoming enlightened. Right now, someplace, who knows? But it's like, that's what's going on. You know, I think Mother Teresa was enlightened, for instance. You know, I think good chance Gandhi was enlightened as well. So there's like people like that just wake up and change the world in very important ways. That's what enlightened beings do. There's another meaning, however, that taking refuge in the Sangha. And it could mean all the people who are practicing the Dhamma in the world today. I mean, right now we're sitting here practicing the Dhamma, and I guarantee you, all over the world right now, there are people doing exactly what we're doing, in the sense of sitting, practicing, studying, absorbing the teachings of the Buddha. It's going on everywhere. It's a universal practice all over the world. There's no place in the world where there isn't someone practicing the Dhamma. That's kind of encouraging, I think. Or on a more personal level, it's like those people who I practice with regularly. Like this little group of people we have here. You four in particular are pretty regular here on Thursday nights. This is you formed a Sangha. Just like that. Every time we sit together and we change refuges, we create a Sangha. That's so important because it encourages us to keep practicing. Being with others who practice encourages us to continue the path. It's a very straight line connect that I've experienced in my own life, in my own retreat practice and daily practice and my practice with, you know, in the community like I have been here in Boulder. It's so true how powerful that energy is to encourage me to keep practicing. And in my case, keep teaching as well. So by taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, we're letting go into a feeling of safety and protection. Remember what refuge means. A refuge is the place that we feel safe and protected. But it arises out of faith, effort, and taking refuge in the Sangha is an act of love. It's like connection with other human beings. So taking refuge is faith, effort, and love. And all three of these are needed for this thing to work, for it to be successful. And a really good way to understand that is to see, well, let's look what happens when one of these three isn't there, which is, you know, in various traditional practices, you'll see this in various ways. So I want to just spend a little bit of time talking about that. If we have faith and we make effort to study the teachings, but we aren't grounded in love for all beings. No metta. Then we easily veer towards fundamentalism, fanaticism, extremism of some sort. Yeah, we know that we're right because our faith is strong and the holy book we study, the Pali Canon, the Bible, the Quran, the Torah, it makes no difference which one of those books you pick. But if you start to believe that it's the only answer, it's the only correct answer, and I know this because I'm right, and all those other people, sorry, there's something missing here. You know, and people use their books and their teachings very selectively, and you see this going on and on all the time. People pick out three verses from the Bible where St. Paul said such and such a thing, and oh wow, that means it's bad and no one should ever do this, and we should make sure nobody else does it either. You know, we're unstoppable. Excuse me. And so on. It's just, and it, like, you see the same thing in the with people doing picking up verses from the Quran or from the Pali Canon. Really, honest to God, you can pick out a verse from, I know of a verse in the Pali Canon that says basically that women can't be enlightened; they have to wait until they get a male body. But this is something that the Pali Canon got fiddled with, like everything else. It's this old. It's been adapted and adjusted. In the original teachings of the Buddha, it was never there. This sort of got slid in later, and then in Theravada Buddhist countries right now to this day, men, male representatives of the monastics point to this to say, "See, you women, you have to wait till next time around." And use it to control things. There's a whole patriarchy that goes on in those countries is startling sometimes. So it's like, it doesn't make any difference. People will do this because they've lost one of those three things to take refuge in. Well, what about if we take refuge in faith and love, but we don't make an effort to understand the practice and teachings we've adopted? What happens is we very easily wander into what I'll call the excesses of the new age flower children. I'm allowed to say that because I was one of them, okay? You know, we love everyone. We're all love, and everything is just blissful and wonderful. Oh, you know, it's like, yeah, I was very sweet, and it is a very sort of sweet energy, but it ignores the fact that we have a dark side. It just totally ignores the fact that there's a shadow side that we have to look at that too, that we have to look at the defilements that arise in our mind, not just all the sweetness and love, and everything's love and sweetness all the time. That's a delusional way of thinking that is very common in the New Age, and actually probably the neo-New Age of Boulder these days, to be honest with you. And if we don't take refuge in the Dhamma is sort of, oh wait, here's a way to do this, but skillfully and acknowledging the truth of things, to see things clearly. Yes, we're full of love and light, but we're also have all these, the dark side as well, and we're trying to balance those out somehow and see them clearly. And what about if we have knowledge and love but no faith? This can easily fall into what Trungpa Rinpoche called spiritual materialism. You know, faith is what anchors us in a particular action. I'm anchored by the teachings of the Buddha in the Theravada tradition. Without that faith, you know, what happens is, well, you know, I sort of like a little bit of this stuff from over here, and a little bit of this from over here, and oh, I like this Vajrayana prayer, so I'll use that sometimes, and on and on and on. And you see this happening a lot in Boulder as well, because there's so many different things available in people in Boulder. And you get this the smorgasbord effect of spirituality, where nothing is solid because there's no continuity to it. It's too loosey goosey, as they say. And there's this classical Indian teaching aphorism, if you want water, you don't dig 10 1-foot holes, you dig 1 10-foot hole. Some of you have probably heard me say this before, but it's like we need to take ourselves in a particular tradition. That's what taking refuge in the Dhamma means. Whether it's this tradition that I'm teaching from or some other one, I don't care which. I'm not saying that this is the tradition or the right tradition. It's just that's the one I know and that's the only one I can teach. But we have to find something and go, yeah, this makes sense for me. It seems to be working. Let's stick with this, dig a deep hole here, once we can hit the water. It's the nature of things. Then the Buddha goes on. So now we've taken refuge. What comes next? Considers us. The imperfections of the mind have in part been given up, expelled, beast abandoned, and relinquished by me. Isn't that interesting? It says, in part being given up. Oh, it doesn't mean like it's all got to be done. And once again, the Buddha is pointing very clearly to we don't need to be perfect, which is where we often get caught. This whole teaching and this whole practice is this process, bit by bit by bit by bit by bit. My old teacher, Swami Vishnu Devananda, he had this wonderful image he used to use. He used to say, how can you change a cotton cloth into a silk cloth? And we'd all go, well, you can't do that. I mean, it's cotton or silk. I mean, And he'd say, no, no, no. You just change it in thread. At a time. One thread at a time. That's what we're doing. We're changing our cloth into a silk cloth. And we're just pulling out one of those old cotton threads and sliding in the silk thread instead. Thread at a time. That's all we can do. So that it really are, in part have given. And that's just an acknowledgement of who we are. And that's what we're doing. We're just trying to replace more threads one by one, slowly, 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 surely. And this goes on. If a bhikkhu of Switchu, such a state of concentration and Swishnam, eats alms food consisting of choice hill rice along with various sauces and curries, even that will be no obstacle for him. In other words, he's given up the desire for fancy food, so if he eats fancy food, it won't make any difference. It's an interesting image that the Buddha uses to say, we don't have to be totally austere all the time. We've started to see things clearly, and austerity in and of itself isn't necessary. It doesn't mean we eat like that every day, but it's like, oh, Don't worry if someone offers you some food that doesn't meet your idea of what austere and pure food is. Just eat it. Just take it. It's an offering. Then he goes on. He abides pervading one quarter with the mind imbued with loving kindness. Likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth. So above, below, around, and everywhere. And to all as to himself, he abides pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, and without ill will. And he goes on and does the other three Brahma Viharas in the same way. So now he's saying, okay, we've dealt with the impurities, we've taken refuge, we start to have this clear, concentrated mind. And then what happens is these wholesome qualities of heart-mind start to arise. The Brahma Viharas are really wholesome qualities of mind that arise so that not only are we not expressing from a place of defilement, we're expressing from a place of loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. That's what comes next. That becomes our, these are called the divine abodes, you know, the Brahma Vihara, the divine abodes. These are the places where our heart lives. And we express that energy in the world. That's how we interact in the world. We interact in the world more and more from a place of the Brahmaharas, from places of loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. Then he says, he understands that there is the inferior, there is the superior, and beyond there's an escape from this whole field of perception. Ah, now we're getting into the more esoteric part where what he's basically saying is we tend to live in a world of duality, of this is better than this, this is inferior, that's superior, there's that sort of word of mental judgment things. But at a certain point, we step beyond that place where we see the world in that way. Now things are getting close to the actual enlightenment experience, which then he says, when he knows he's thus, his mind is liberated from the taint of sensual desire, from the taint of being, and from the taint of ignorance. When it is liberated, there comes the knowledge. It is liberated. He understands. Birth is destroyed. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done had been done. There's no more coming to any state of being. Bhikkhus, this bhikkhu is called unbathed with the inner bathing. So he's saying, at that point, now you're enlightened. This is where enlightenment arises, when we've really established everything that comes before this, step by step by step by step, one thread at a time. But it's interesting, he uses this term, this is the inner bathing. What's this all about? Well, there is in India, in particular, these traditions around bathing in certain places, being ways to sort of wash away your sins, to sort of all the unwholesome things you've done in your up to then are just washed away if you bathe in the river at this place at that time. I have experience in this, actually. I was in India in 1987, traveling with my then teacher, who was in the yoga tradition. And we actually hiked up to the source of the Ganges. And the source of the Ganges is at 15,000 feet in a valley. At 15,000, so you're surrounded by mountains that are 22, 23,000 feet. But it's a valley, and there's a glacier. Now, the glacier's probably retreated some since I was there 35 years ago. But it's basically this big glacier, and there's a cave, essentially a cave, where the Ganges comes gushing out of this cave. And traditionally, you bathe right there. Now, this is like ice melt water coming literally right off the... But it's, so it's like, I can see why my people might think it purifies. Because it was probably the coldest bath I ever took in my entire life. It was like a very quick in and out, shall we say. But it was sort of like it took an enormous amount of effort and faith to get there. So I understood the thinking behind it, in a sense, like to hike up to 15,000 feet in this trail. It was like, at this point, you're 10 miles, maybe 8 miles from the nearest town, which is a town, it's a temple and a few little huts, right? To this, to where the source of the Ganges was an experience, and taking that dip in the river was very invigorating and jolting. But it didn't cleanse me of all my it didn't work, whatever it was supposed to do. It was interesting and a powerful experience. So when he's talking the inner bathing, what he's talking about is don't believe just going to bathe at the source of the Ganges, or don't believe that to Kumbh Mela if you bathe there, or don't believe if you go to Haridwar, which is a very holy town I've been to on the banks of Ganges further down, and you bathe there, that's it, you're perfect, everything, now you've taken care of everything, right? These are traditional beliefs in the Hindu practice in particular. It's just, and he's actually referring to traditional thinking. But what he's also saying is what you need to do instead is have the inner bathing. It has to come from inside. It can't be some external force that you bathe in. You have to bathe inside. It's the inner bathing that's important. So then this whole sutta, a discourse to a particular Brahman. And the Brahman received the going forth from the Blessed One and received the full admission. And soon, not long after his full admission, dwelling alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and resolute, the venerable Bharavaja, by realizing for himself with direct knowledge, here and now, entered upon and abided in that supreme goal, holy life. So the person who listened to this original time when the Buddha taught this, when the Buddha's teachings, then he went forth in order to become a monastic. And then he became enlightened. Oh, here's another enlightened being in the world brought about by the Buddha's teachings. This is a constant theme in the teachings. Remember, and I wrote myself a note here. Remember that this is what we're doing. We're heading towards enlightenment. We're in this process, and it's the process that's important. Don't worry too much about the endpoint. Other than, yeah, that we understand that that exists, but we're in the midst of this process. This is why we practice, because we're engaging in the process, and if we engage in the process, we have to practice. And here's the other thing. This is harder and something I've had to learn probably over and over again. Don't get discouraged when, quote, nothing's happening. I've been caught there more than once in my years of practice. Like, I keep doing all this practice and nothing's happening. Believe me, every time you practice, every time you study the Dhamma, every time you sit with other people, every time you sit by yourself, something's happening. And it's so subtle. The cloth is so big and there's so many threads that we don't see it. Sometimes for long periods of time, it's sort of, this process, like we go along for a while and then something happens. Maybe it's sometimes on retreat or just in daily life, and we go, and we go along, and that's what's happening. It's slow, slow, slow progress. And then there's these moments that sort of we take a leap somehow. But that's just the nature of the practice. It isn't instantaneous. It is often so. Things are happening on just a subtle level that we can't even see them. It feels like nothing's happening because our culture has taught us to want to happen really quickly, right? Sorry, but ain't gonna happen. This is something that takes time. This is all about the process. Course, I have a bit of poetry. Describes this. This is some from Dana Fald's book, Going in. There's one of her poems I really like because it talks about this. It's called Enough. It's enough to offer love, no matter how imperfectly received or given. It's enough to try and fail at a difficult task. Enough to fall and rise, stumble, fall again, sigh, and start to walk, however slowly, in the direction the soul points. It's enough to seek peace and find pain, to gain nothing but a vision of truth and take the long route home. It's enough to feel temptation, the dance of the senses, the hot pull of desire, enough to call on God, walk through fire, sleep and cry in fear, or welcome dying. It's enough to be and breathe, to feel the touch of wind on skin. It's enough to take the day as it comes, to watch the ripples on the lake as the rock sinks to the bottom, to see the wild reflection of the surface calm into a mirror once again. It's enough to hear the voice of fear and hide, or seek it out and face the shame or shadows. It's enough to set out to tame demons and watch them multiply instead. It's enough to be buffeted by the winds of change and not be blown over. I in you and all of us, more than enough. That's a pretty good description of what this practice is like. I think not easy, but it's really wonderful at the same time. It's enough.